Remember being a kid dropping pennies in fountains or wells? You'd close your eyes and make a wish. And technically, you could make a wish anywhere, anytime. But something about all those other pennies waiting for yours felt magical. And I don't know about you, but I always took that decision about what to wish for really, really seriously. I haven't seen a fountain full of pennies in a while, but right now at the Kansas City Public Library, there's an art exhibit that reminds me of that whole experience. It's called Hear Where You Wish. I'm Gina Kaufman, and the artist behind it, Ryan Wilkes, is with me now on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Ryan.
Oh my gosh, hi.
So you've basically created a public altar for making wishes. Explain that.
I did. And I love the metaphor of that, of the pennies. I mean, I didn't even think about that. But it is. There's something significant about all the other pennies waiting for yours. We've built Sean Pruden built the altar. He did all the woodworking for it. It's a 40 square foot altar. And it's made to house everybody's objects of personal significance and personal power.
So wait, what do you mean by objects of personal significance or personal power?
So this altar has a bunch of shelving units, and everybody in Kansas City is encouraged to bring one of those objects, something that means something to them, something that carries some sort of weight, and leave it on the altar as an offering. And it's going to be up for 3 months, so I'm really excited to see what kind of objects mean something to people.
And people are supposed to truly leave them forever?
Yes, they're not going to get them back, most likely. I'm looking into permanently turning them into a sculpture at some point to memorialize them, but that's further down the line.
So what happens? What is the idea of leaving these objects that mean something to you in a public place and leaving them forever?
I think it's kind of the same concept as if you like go to a grave site and you leave flowers. It's just like this offering to something invisible. So I think that there's a lot of power in all the pennies being together, and there's a lot of power in metaphor of everybody's objects being together and this kind of, community offering. And I'm not asking people to bring anything like their grandmother's, wedding ring. Of course, don't bring anything of monetary value unless you're comfortable with never seeing it again. But for instance, my stepmother's coming, and I'm really excited for her to come because we've, not gotten along in the past, and we've had a lot of ideological differences. And she asked if she could leave a Bible, and I was like, "Of course, that means something to you. Like, this altar has a place for everything."
So, where does the wishing come into it?
So Sean Pruden, who I'm collaborating with, has also built and hand-planed a beautiful table out of a couple different types of wood. And on this table, it's about a 5-foot by 3-foot table. It stands at about 3.5 feet high. There's going to be like pens and paper everywhere so that you can write down your wish. And I'm going to have verbiage on the walls that really encourages people to go deeper with their wishes because
So, no, they shouldn't necessarily come having already figured out their wish.
No, I think the space will lend itself to getting people into the headspace to make a wish there.
Okay, so I am curious, how did this whole idea come about?
Well, I'm actually holding in my hand how this idea came about. I was walking 2 years ago. I've been harnessing this idea for 2 years,
You
and
just
wait.
showed me a rock.
I did show you a
And I
rock.
didn't notice you were holding a rock until just now.
Well, it helps me, speak, I think, a little bit more clearly on the idea of this project, because I really believe that ideas are things. They have thoughts, and they want to be brought into the world, and they choose people. So I found this rock on the sidewalk in the crossroads about 2 years ago, and someone had written on the rock in Sharpie, "This rock grants wishes." And it was at the time where thoughts and prayers were becoming a thing that was like highly discussed, especially with all the shootings and everything. Every time there was a shooting, people would talk about thoughts and prayers, and a lot of people were discounting thoughts and prayers without action is useless. And I think the same applies to a wish. A wish without action is just wishful thinking. And so I started thinking about wishes a lot because I am not a religious person, and a lot of people I know are not religious, but they also have this human desire to connect to something invisible. It's just like it's in our DNA. It's a human thing. And a wish is a non-religious prayer, and anybody can make a wish. And I think that, you know, I made a wish 2 years ago that this project would come into fruition, that the right people would be brought into my life to collaborate with. And now I'm collaborating with Sean, Ari, and Tim.
The other people working on this
altar. Mm-hmm.
What are so you mentioned what Sean is doing. He's built this shelving unit that people can put their objects on when they make a wish and when they leave it. What are Ari and Tim doing? It's so, Ari Fish and Tim Hart.
It is. So Ari Fish has, so every square inch of the wall space in the gallery has been painted with sigils, which are just like symbols, symbols of significance. You can make, like, the cross is a sigil. It's just a symbol that has power attached to it. So there's a lot of alchemaic symbols. Gold is a highly utilized element in this project. The whole altar is painted in gold stripes. So the alchemaic symbol for gold is all over the walls. And Ari has made 16 3 foot by 60 inch veils that you walk through like a labyrinth. They hang from the ceiling, and you just navigate through them like this little beautiful transparent maze, and it's kind of like this wash. So as you approach the altar, which is actually visually cut off from the entrance of the gallery because of the veils, so you walk through the veils, and by the time you get to the altar, you're kind of like, you know, so immersed in this experience that you've kind of left everything else behind, which is, I think, a good headspace to be in when you approach the altar to make a wish. And once you get to the altar, there are speakers on it playing Tim J. Hart. Okay, so Tim J. Hart is one of my best friends, and he has made this musical composition out of wine glasses. He's the first person in history to figure out a way to notate wine glass music. And he is going to be tonight performing a ritual of wine glasses. He's going to be on the floor surrounded in wine glasses, and he's going to perform it so that it will be recorded then, tonight, and be played on a loop for 3 months. So when you go to the altar, you're going to have this like really ethereal like sound of just harmonizing deep and high tones of wine glasses. And it's almost like disorienting a little bit. Not disorienting in a bad way, but like calming. You know, a lot of spiritual practices use sound to get into a headspace of like connectivity. And that's what Tim's offering is.
Well, that's cool. So do you think, I mean, the ritual around all of this, some of it is original ritual, like the veils or the wine glass offering. But some of these symbols are symbols that exist in existing belief systems. You know what I mean? That that people, the people who believe in those religions, say like the cross, to see all of those symbols with symbols of other belief systems, like that could be disorienting for those people who have that very specific kind of attachment. You know what I mean?
I do. I know what you mean. And I've been conscious of that. I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, that was good. Conscious.
I had to correct myself. Yeah, I do think that, so the altars, I know people that are going to bring, you know, Buddhist stuff, Buddhist objects. I know people that are going to bring Muslim objects, Christian objects. But this is for everyone. And the symbols, the alchemy symbols that are on there, alchemy isn't a spiritual practice. It was originally designed in Egypt and then pretty much appropriated by Europeans to make symbols that were secret, that were kept secret from the Pope so that other alchemists could practice and use their own language to communicate with each other. So really, it's just like when I put the symbol for one of the biggest symbols that are all over the wall is the symbol for arsenic, which a lot of people are like, ooh, that's death. But arsenic was used for healing properties, for magical healing properties, and for also, you know, killing people. So, and I think that's the nature of a wish. You can wish for something good, for something healing, and you can also wish for destruction, you know?
Yeah, that just got kind of dark.
It did, but I think that's the nature of what this project is. It's both. It's the balance of it. And I think people, I don't anticipate a lot of dark wishes happening. I really don't, because the world needs some good so much. People need some good. And so I hope that people make good wishes, but I also understand that it is also human nature to want harm, I guess. And I don't necessarily encourage that, but it is the nature of it.
You know, there's something else about this that really intrigues me, which is the idea of wishing in code, like using symbols and objects, and a certain kind of almost like personal language for wishing instead of a language that is clearly understood by other people. You know, like when you're blowing out birthday candles, you're not supposed to tell anyone what you wish for. It's mm-hmm. not going to come true. Or like with the pennies in the well, you're not supposed to tell anybody what you wish for. What do you think that's about?
I think it's I think that it's a matter of vulnerability, honestly, because I mean, to speak out loud to another person what it is that you truly desire is scary. And Brené Brown actually talks about this, and I always talk about Brené Brown because she really has saved my life in a lot of ways.
Like a popular author, motivational speaker,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
She has a couple books out. One of them is called The Power of Vulnerability, and she talks about, she's a qualitative researcher that has developed over 12 years research that discusses shame, vulnerability, fear, and empathy. And she says that all of the research that she's gathered indicates and always points to that the most difficult human emotion for us to express and share with each other is joy. So I think that there's this barrier, there's this thing that we don't want to share our wishes with people. We don't want to share our truest desires with people because that's a vulnerability of joy and hope. And that's something that is scientifically proven through Brené's work to be the most difficult thing to share with people.
But okay, do you think that wishes are joyful? Because I have been thinking about this, getting ready for this show, and I can't decide whether wishes are hopeful or actually very sad. I mean, I think it's important to hope for things, but there's something about the word wish mm-hmm. that is melancholy.
Lack.
Yeah, because it's the distance between what's true and what you wish were true.
Mm-hmm. It does indicate lack a little bit. But I think though that's why when I say that I want people to go deeper with their wishes, I think this ties in a little bit because, you know, knee-jerk reactions, knee-jerk wishes are, I wish for $1 million. I wish I had a partner. I wish I had a bigger house. I wish I didn't live in this neighborhood. I wish I had a car that worked. You know, like there's all these things that like, if we wish for, would make our lives more convenient and more functional. But I think there's a deeper, and I want people to come to this and be encouraged to have a deeper wish. Like, what do you want to see in your life? What do you really want to manifest in your life? What do you want to see in the world happen? You know, if you do truly want $1 million, what do you have standing in your way that's keeping you from getting that? Is it fear of success? Is it, you know, is it shutting down all of your good ideas that could be financially viable? Like, what could you bring into your life that could manifest what you want?
Do you think that writing down a wish or speaking a wish aloud is important? Or do you think that just simply thinking really hard, setting down the object, going through some kind of making the wish concrete is enough? I mean, in the promotional materials for the show, you say it's about the power of a wish if we are bold enough to confide it.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's absolutely vital to write down a wish because let's talk about internal dialogue. I, for instance, and I think this is shared with a lot of people, sometimes have to tell myself to be nicer to myself because I say really horrible things to myself. You know, sometimes I'll wake up in a fit of anxiety and I'll say stuff to myself like, everybody's mad at you. Everybody hates you. You're the worst. And if I wrote that down, and if I spoke that out loud instead of thinking it, would I agree with it? Like if I spoke out loud, everyone hates you, to myself in the mirror, that would feel really, it would feel more powerful. It would have more impact. And then it would kind of feel wrong. So I think in the same instance as that, speaking out loud a wish and writing down a wish so you can see it with your eyeballs so that you can like really consume it and make it material. That is important, I think, to make a wish.
Ryan Wilkes, thank you so much and good luck at the opening tonight.
Thank you.
Ryan's exhibit, Wish You Were Here Where You Wish, opens tonight, 5:30 to 7:30 at the central branch of the Kansas City Public Library. That's the one downtown. Up next, we all know that Kansas City jazz was a thing, but do you know about Kansas City soul? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. When filmmaker Anthony Laddish started following around this serious record collector named Johnny Stark, he was hoping to go to, like, flea shops and stuff. He pictured shots of Johnny digging through stacks of vinyl, so he'd be there when he made that one amazing find, which he would then follow from junk bin to dance floor. That's not quite how it panned out.
Hey, man, it's Johnny. I think I have a record. You're not going to like the way I found it, but it's our record, man. I can feel it. Give me a buzz.
We'll talk about how Johnny found the record in just a minute, but first, the record itself.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime record. Tony Ashley was a Kansas City artist in the 60s. Who had the most amazing voice. He made these songs that were so sweet you'd cry, and songs so rough that you had to dance.
Here it is, Tony Ashley, Just a Taste.
I'm not asking you to spend a lifetime with me. Exclusively, all I want is just a taste. All your lips is just a taste. All I need is just a taste.
The short film about this record, the guy who made it, the guy who found it, and the history of soul music in Kansas City is called 45, The Search for Soul, and it's showing next Friday at the Kansas City Film Festival. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with filmmaker Anthony Laddish. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Gina, how are you?
Good, and record collector Johnny Stark. Hi, Johnny. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having us.
So, I'm going to start with you, Anthony. The idea for the movie, like, tell us the backstory.
Years ago, I made a different film about record collecting because I've been collecting records since I was a kid, and if I'm being honest, I don't think I really did that great of a job. It just kind of turned out to be 15 minutes of people telling stories about collecting records, and I struggled with the idea of how to really create a narrative. And then now years later, and Johnny and I are friends, and John's a filmmaker as well, and we work together a lot, and I kind of, knowing Johnny and his voracious appetite specifically for soul music, I'd kind of crafted this idea that I wanted to make a movie that I could shoot really quickly, show him out digging for records, taking him home, putting him in his collection, then putting it back on the dance floor.
One character, one story.
One character, one story. That's kind of my bag.
All right. And Johnny, I mean, what about you? How did you get into record collecting and soul music?
I think I could probably blame that on my parents. I just grew up in a household where music was really, really, really prevalent. And, we had vinyl everywhere in our house. It's how my dad listened to music. And so for me, it wasn't this cool niche thing. It was just how you listen to music when I was young. And, we always had, my parents always listened to 60s music. There was a lot of soul music and rhythm and blues. So it's just kind of a thing that I grew up with. And as I got older and started realizing that the things that I knew weren't all of the soul music. I started seeking out the kind of obscure, more interesting tracks that I didn't know existed.
Just the sense that there had to be more out there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I remember the early songs that I started hearing that were like, wow, why doesn't everyone know this? And it really pushed me to try to find more of the music that was unheard, forgotten, that deserved to be heard.
But for you, did Kansas City have something to do with it, like a sort of local pride, or is it more complicated than that, the Kansas City piece of it? Because you have a lot of 45s made here in Kansas City.
Yeah, I think that the city has a lot to do with it. I love Kansas City. I think Kansas City is an incredible city that nationally doesn't get held in the high regard it deserves. But I think more than anything, going to these flea markets and thrift stores and estate sales, I was able to find the records that were made here. And that really pushed me to realize, okay, this is going to be the place that I'm going to find these records. So I ended up just focusing on the music that was here. And once I started learning that there was so much incredible music that was made here that no one was really talking about, it really made that drive stronger to go find those records.
Did finding them make you feel differently about Kansas City?
I think that I think most people that know me know that I'm a little obsessed with history and tradition and things of that nature. And thinking of Kansas City, you know, we always think of the 20s or the 30s, and you think of this really incredible place where jazz music was everywhere and there were clubs and people were coming here from New York or LA to really kind of get that gritty culture that
dim, you know, lighting around the clock.
Exactly. You know, and I think that this music opened up a different Kansas City that I wanted to visualize, this 1960s Kansas City where all of these musicians were here making this incredible music that, you know, it's still hard for me to visualize how it was received by the people that did live here, you know, and especially with some of the research Tony's been doing, getting to talk to some of these people that were around and hear their, you know, version of what it was like makes it so much more exciting for me to, like, to visualize this music that, you know, I know, oh, this was recorded in 1966. I can close my eyes and think about, all right, so 1966, these four kids went into the studio on the Paseo and made this record, and it, you know, it was, to them, it was everything. And then somehow it completely gets lost in history.
So we're going to get into Kansas City soul music in a lot more depth later, but I want to start doing that with the record you found that Tony's movie is about. So, Anthony, tell me about the story of the record that you both kind of explore in this short film.
Well, I think the story of the record is it's kind of, I think that's more Johnny's story, really. But John, I think, I mean, the story of the record and the story of the artist are two different things. So the I can tell you the story of the artist, which is that Tony Ashley was a guy who was from a small town in Missouri, and he came to Kansas City to make it in the music business. And he signed to Forte Records, which was a record label that was run by a guy named Ellis Taylor. And he put out one record on Forte. And I think Ellis recognized that Tony was going to have the potential to be a big star. And so he had, through some, you know, business dealings, worked it out with Decca Records to get that Forte record re-released on Decca. And then Decca actually signed Tony Ashley out of Kansas City to a national record deal. And so they sent him to Memphis, where he recorded with Willie Mitchell, and really upped the game of the production value. And so what you heard there with Just a Taste, and if you listen, there's four songs that were recorded for with Willie Mitchell. And if you listen to any of those next to anything that was recorded in Kansas City, The thing that I'm learning, as I do more and more research and as I talk to musicians that were around and that were on some of these records, was that Kansas City...
Because you are now working on a feature-length film.
I am. Yeah, I'm working on a feature-length film about Kansas City soul music. And the one thing that people will tell you is that, like, Kansas City did not know how to make a hit record. It wasn't that we didn't know how to write a hit record. It was that Kansas City, for whatever reason, didn't know how... We didn't have a producer that could make a record that sounded like a hit record. So despite anyone's desire to turn Cowtown into Motown, we just didn't have a producer here that necessarily knew how to make that record. And then when you listen to the same artist, a song produced here in Kansas City, and then he goes and he records with Willie Mitchell, who's this, you know, famous producer who's just incredible. And the difference between the sonics of those two recordings is like somebody taking a blanket off of the speakers. And so the record that we found is rare a lot because Decca released one of Tony's records and it kind of didn't necessarily go anywhere, but it was fantastic record. And then they released a second record and he was murdered. And the details of which are foggy, and we're, you know, kind of really deep into trying to research all of that. But he was murdered, and so Decca pulled all the records, and so there's very few of them that even exist anymore. And Johnny happened to find a copy of this, and, you know, we'll kind of leave the how to the movie so people come see the movie. But, we found this copy of the record, and... the one thing that we didn't get into in the movie that I will say is that we're pretty well convinced that, and I'll say this and I'll stop and let Johnny take this over because I think, he'll have some wisdom here, but we're pretty well convinced that the copy that we have actually belonged to Tony Ashley.
Whoa.
So take it away, John.
It's definitely, I think that for me, the Crate Diggers that came before me here in Kansas City really kind of kicked that door open and kind of put these artists on high for you know, younger people like me who, when we kind of got into the scene, were like, oh, great, so Tony Ashley, the Trinicas, Louis Shashir, these people, you know, all that legwork was already done, so it was easy for us to be like, okay, so these are the artists that I need to learn about, you know, find out about, find their records, see if I can find something that maybe somebody doesn't know about them. And I think, you know, Tony Ashley is being a forte artist.
Tell me more about that.
So Forte was probably the most prominent soul label that came out of Kansas City. And for anyone that really wants to learn about it, Numero out of Chicago did this incredible recap of the label. And like all the releases, it's really thoughtful, well done. There's a lot of good information. And, you know, they do a really good job with the care of presenting the music. So it's not just, we took a 45 and threw it back into the world in a digital format. They, they restore what they can. Things come from master tapes.
They're incredible. They have incredible liner notes. If you want to know the history of Forte, I would definitely check out that Numero comp.
With all of this history, and I'm just curious, you mentioned in the movie that these records and this music has either been willfully forgotten or accidentally forgotten. What's your theory on that? Why don't people... There's like a niche, like cult following for it, but that's not like mainstream Kansas City history knowledge.
Sure, and I think Tony made a really interesting point here where Kansas City might not have known how to make a hit record, but not everybody wants to hear a hit record. And for me specifically, the soul that comes out of these records that aren't, you know, Motown music machine quality records, that's something that I find really interesting because it has a character all on its own, being this thing that was made either with poor quality microphones or tape that's been reused 100 times over. You know, and I think that adds to the character of this music. And you see that with...
Is it like, I kind of relate to what you're saying. It's almost like you're closer to the making of it because you can hear the evidence of it being created.
It definitely feels more real.
It's the difference between going to watch Black Panther and then watching a movie that somebody made and put on YouTube and they shot it on their phone. It's like you feel closer to the means of production, I think, in some ways. At least for me, it sounds rougher. It sounds tougher.
And I think, honestly, being filmmakers, you know, I remember in the mid-90s when I was seeing films like Clerks or things like that, I was like,
oh,
I can do that. I can do that. Why don't I do this? And I think that's the thing about private press or local records is they make you realize, like, these are just real people.
You know, I want to play another clip. It's another Tony Ashley song. We heard the song Just a Taste that's in the record you find in this short film. Let's hear a little more Tony Ashley music. This song is I'll Never Be Satisfied. So, tell me more about Tony Ashley.
So, with all of these artists that I try to research here in Kansas City, it's really great when I can find someone that was connected to them or have some history with them. And I was able to locate Tony's brother, who gave me this really incredible insight into his life and how he kind of got into music. There's a rhythm and blues singer named Little Willie John that I really love. I mean, his music's just incredible. And Tony's brother told me this story that, and of course I'm going to botch the year, I think it's 55 or 56, Little Willie John came to the town in Missouri that they lived and played, and Tony Ashley got out, and I mean, Tony must have been 14, 15 years old, and got to see Little Willie John play. And he said that he waited behind the stage door till 2 in the morning, and then Little Willie John came out and actually spent maybe an hour talking to Tony Ashley. And he said that changed Tony Ashley's life. He said that my brother, from that day forward, wanted to be a musician, and that's all he ever cared about. And, you know, for me to get these stories like this about people that I only know through their songs, it's just so incredible for me.
More about Tony Ashley?
Well, I think the thing for me about Tony it deals a little bit with the tragedy of his murder, which is that he was a guy that I really truly, when you listen to this music, you can hear a guy who's really on the brink of success, and you can hear a guy, a voice that is just begging for more people to hear it and more people to know about it. And the fact that he was struck down really, like, not even in his prime, like before his prime, it just makes this just like a tragedy for the ages. I just absolutely,
yeah,
I'm fascinated by everything to do with it.
In just a moment, we will be talking about the whole soul music scene here in Kansas City in the 60s and 70s and the people who still dance to that stuff today. If you remember the scene or know something about it, we're trying to piece together the history. So now's the time to call 816-235-2888 and join the conversation. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here now with Johnny Stark and Anthony Laddish. Johnny is a record collector who searches out old soul 45s made in Kansas City. Anthony is a filmmaker who made a short film about Johnny and is now working on a full-length feature film about Kansas City soul. Hi again, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
So we are talking about soul music in Kansas City. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a favorite song or artist or know a piece of the history that we haven't shared. 816-235-2888. What would you guys consider, like, the heyday of Kansas City soul? And just tell me a little bit about more about not the music itself necessarily, but like where people would have heard it, that kind of thing.
Well, I think so. Not necessarily historical to the 60s and 70s, but historical to the history of soul music, of what Kansas City soul music is and means, was that in the 90s, you know, Johnny mentioned this, that there, you know, there was a crew of record collectors in Kansas City that were all like art kids.
I remember.
you know, your James Trotters and Pat Alexander is another great Kansas City soul guy, and Thomas and Dante and these guys that all did this thing called the Hustlers Convention, and they would throw these massive parties, and they were spinning all this Kansas City soul music. So I truly believe that these guys are responsible for anybody even knowing that this music exists a lot, because when you think about it, and it's like, I know a lot of old, you know, musicians that were around at the time, and a lot of these musicians didn't even know that this music was being made in Kansas City at all. Because Kansas City is so racially divided that, you know, you really, generally speaking, nobody would cross the tracks to go to a black club and see, you know, black soul bands.
But presumably there were black audiences.
There were black audiences. And then the other thing that's really interesting is that it was like, you would play in the, clubs, and in Kansas City, Missouri, clubs closed down at a certain time, and so these bands would play, and they would play until, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock, and then they would literally pack up their stuff and they would head over to Kansas City, Kansas, where the clubs were open until 5 a.m. and they would go and they would play another gig, and they would play all night long, basically. And
Is it that nobody knew, or that no white people knew?
I don't think that. Well, no, it's not that no. Yeah, it's not that no one knew. It's that no. You know, no, I don't think, you know, white musicians or white music fans were necessarily crossing the street to go, you know, see these bands. And though I will say the one caveat to that is that for the feature, we interviewed a guy named Alan Bell, who is really significant in that he booked a lot of these bands. He was the booking agent and manager for a lot of these bands, and largely he was booking them into like white high schools and fraternities and military bases. And so, you know, you didn't have to cross the street necessarily to go see these bands. So there was some exposure there, but it's really shocking to me how many people have no idea that this was it's like a secret history of Kansas City, because we're known for jazz and nobody ever really talks about this whole music. So,
well, and I think a big thing that, should be put into this story is that, Marva Whitney is probably one of the most well-known artists to come out of Kansas City's soul scene. And I think that we just picked up pretty young by James Brown and got put on tour with him, made records through King that he produced. And when she came back to Kansas City, which I'm probably going to guess is 69, 70, she got tied in with Ellis Taylor on his Forte label and got to put out a lot of great music here in Kansas City.
You know, I was surprised that Marva Whitney was not on the list of musicians that you were going to play for us today. You did bring in some music, and I want to start with what you call the funkiest record to come out of Kansas City. And I almost don't want to say anything else to set it up, because this song is recognizable to me, and I think it might be to a lot of other people. I didn't know it was a Kansas City song. So let's give it a listen. Okay, explain.
I don't remember exactly when I heard this song for the first time, but there's something so magical about it. I mean, it's the 60s in one song. I mean, it's this beautiful kind of protest and empowerment song, and, you know, it's very beautiful, it's very funky. 1969, I believe. You know, and it's the only record that Curtis Liggins ever made. And it's got a lot of really incredible Kansas City musicians on it, and it's pretty well known. Like you said, you'd heard it before, and not a lot of people think of it as a Kansas City record. And I think it's a record that gets played everywhere. I mean, I think there are DJs in Germany, England, you know, everywhere playing this record, and not a lot of people tie it in with Kansas City, even though if you look at the label says KC Soul right across the top of it. And the really heartbreaking thing is that Curtis Liggins died in 1972 in a car accident. And this record, which is considered by a lot of people just a promo record, a record that he made to help get him gigs on the road, get exposure, you know, not a record that would have been commercially sold. It's a little frustrating, I think, for anyone that loves music to hear these stories, because you want to know what else was going to come next.
I want to hear, we'll talk some more in a second, but I want to make sure that we hear some more music. And I want to play what you say all the record collectors in town are after, at least people who are searching out those Soul 45s. In this case, it's the producer who's from here, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, so the producer is from here, and this is Louis Shashir, who produced this record, and has a career well outside of Kansas City, and is highly regarded. He produced this record. The girls who sing on this record are actually from Oklahoma, OKC, and they came down here to record this record. So this record was recorded actually right over by Kauffman Stadium in a studio called Cavern.
Okay, let's listen,
yeah. And
then we'll come back and talk about why everyone's after this record. So, I mean, other than the fact that this is just a cool-sounding record...
So cool.
What's the deal? What is it that makes this the sought-after thing?
You know, I think those are my words, and I think that the reason I use those words is that it was actually sampled in a record that in the early 2000s was... I think a record that turned a lot of younger people, and especially a white audience, onto older soul music. The group was called Jurassic 5, and they sampled the intro to that, which you can thank all of the people that came before me, you know, the James Trotters and the Dantes, for finding that record and wanting to get it in the hands of DJs who worked with bands like Jurassic 5. And I think it's just one of those things that... it's a record that didn't have legs really before that Jurassic 5 sample. I think that I've heard people say, oh, I had a box of those and I was selling them for $10. And now it's a record that, I mean, if you can get it for under $500, it's, you know, that's a pretty good get.
Let's talk to Janice in Kansas City, Missouri, about her memories of this stuff. Janice, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you very much. I appreciate the show today.
What can you tell us?
I graduated from Van Horn High School in 1967, and we had Little Willie and the Hideaways. Now, is that the same Willie that your guests are referring to?
No, it's actually not. Little Willie was a local act here, but I've actually always wanted to hear Little Willie's music, and I know he made an acetate. But I've heard some incredible stories about especially his live performance.
Yes, yes. And I was there at some dance where, and actually he came multiple times to Van Horn. I ran into him at a jazz venue not too long ago, maybe several years ago, and he remembered his Van Horn gigs. But we even had one evening where we opened up the doors and went outside into our patio, and the janitors told us to lock up when we left, and they left. And another interesting thing was his James
Wait, so the
Brown,
students the students just like hosted a show and the school kind of was like,
well,
see ya.
I think it was one of our major dances, like after basketball or track season, where we, you know, we did the crowning of the princess and the king and the queen. But then we all got down and seriously boogied. And I was a serious a boogie dancer at that point in my life.
Well, what,
still enjoy it.
What can you tell us about the spirit of it at the time when it was being performed live, too? Like, we're talking about the record collecting, but you were there face-to-face with these musicians.
Right, right. And I think those of us who felt like we were really in the groove felt that we were on the cutting edge of cosmopolitan. And I think it really made us feel like we were, you know, into the Kansas City groove. Another thing that was very popular at that period of time was the Boom Boom Room and the Vanguard. I don't know if you're... guests are aware of those venues, but the Boom Boom Room was one of the most, what was it, the classiest dance club you could go to if you were under 18 or 21, and it was on Main. You went upstairs, and they always had a most excellent band, and often they were the Kansas City soul bands and rock, and we didn't use the word funk back then, but it was pre-funk, I guess, and we would have a good time in the Boom Boom Room. the Vanguard tended to be more folk music, so
super interesting.
If you could hit both of those clubs on the same night, that was a hot date.
Well, thanks, Janice, for sharing those memories.
Well, thank you, and I'll hang up and continue listening. And I'm so glad your guests are doing research on this. It's an important element of Kansas City's music that we continue to learn about. Thank you.
Thanks. You know, Anthony, you've mentioned that you have been doing a lot of research. Is there anything else that just you want to jump in and say right now? We haven't heard from you in a while.
I'm just enjoying listening to Johnny talk about it's so funny because the Pat Alexander is along for the ride with me making this feature. And I'm sure we're going to be tapping into Johnny's wealth of knowledge and resources as well along the way. And it's just been really incredible for us to be able to go out and talk to people. So there was a band in Kansas City called Tommy and the Derbies, and it was Tommy and James Gadson, the Gadson brothers, that had this band. And James Gadson went on to play with Bill Withers and played on a lot of Motown hits. And you know, we were able to go out and talk to James, and hearing him talk about the Carpets, and which was the band that they had before Tommy and the Derbies, you know, hearing what it was like to be like a 13-year-old kid sneaking out of the house to go make doo-wop records, and you know, has been just absolutely enlightening to me.
We have a clip here that Johnny brought in. Is the Derbies? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, this is an early one for them.
Let's give it a listen. I need somebody. So, tell me more. I mean, you can definitely hear that thing you were talking about before about it's not the perfect production, but it's intimate, I'd say.
Oh yeah, it's definitely, and I think the great thing about these local kind of records are they kind of transcend a time where this song really has elements of 50s doo-wop with rhythm and blues, but it's still this early soul record.
Is there anything else to say about, is there a Kansas City sound in soul, or is that the production sound is the Kansas City sound?
Well, I think one thing is that I think the in Kansas City soul music, I think the drummers were funky, and that goes back, I think, a lot to our history with Kansas City jazz and the fact that, you know, a lot of these sort of like four on the floor, you know, swinging rhythms came you know, from Kansas City, from Kansas City Big Band. And I just think the drums were funky and the guitars were rough. And that's kind of what made Kansas City, Kansas City.
Anything to add to that, Johnny?
Just get out there and listen to whatever you can. There's so much good music that came from here. It all needs to be heard.
One tip on where to find it.
I think that Forte comp from Numero is a really good starting point.
And also the Kansas City Film Festival.
Well, yeah, we'll give those details in just a second, but our time is up. Johnny Stark, thank you. Good luck with the crate digging.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And filmmaker Anthony Laddish, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
Anthony's short film about Johnny and a record we heard earlier is called 45, The Search for Soul, and it'll be showing at the Kansas City Film Festival next Friday. Check their schedule for the details. And that is it for today's show and for the week. You can listen back to anything you missed or just want to hear again at kcur.org/Central Standard. Check out yesterday's conversation about the movie Love, Simon with the local artist Boy Boy and weatherman Gary Lezak. And on Wednesday, we talked to a guy who organized pickets in downtown Kansas City, Kansas to protest hiring discrimination in the 1960s. He has some words about where we're headed today. KCUR.org/Central Standard. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan with help from intern Matt Groby. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.